the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, our picks for the games of the weekend didn't deliver too many goals over the weekend, but there were still plenty of goals elsewhere and talking points across J1 for us to sink our teeth into on this episode.
Yeah, there was. And in our defence, I thought as nil-nils go, they were quite decent nil-nils. But yeah, there's plenty elsewhere. Some of it not so great. Some clubs that are really starting to annoy me. But I think the league is really settling in now. 7 games, we've kind of got an idea of where teams are going to shape up. And yeah, there are lots of talking points to get into.
Most definitely. And yeah, maybe a great time of the season to have our guest on for his thoughts on what's transpired in the top flight so far. It's always great to welcome Dan Ulowitz from the Japan Times back to the pod. Dan, taking a break from figure skating duty for a while to join us. Great to have you with us.
Good to be back. It's nice to focus on goals and yellow cards, I guess, instead of quad lutzes and toe flips, and I could go on and on, but then it would turn into a 2-hour episode.
Well, yeah, I actually wouldn't mind one day picking your brain on how you prepare for an event like that, Dan, and how much you have to study up beforehand. But yes, we do have other pressing matters to attend to. And so Dan will be joining us basically for part one of this episode. The first 4 games we'll review of match day 7. And plenty of questions for us to throw at Dan as well before we let him go and finish wrapping up the match day. And as we have done so far this season, when I've remembered to, we've always led off the episode with teams winning for the first time in this new campaign. And we had 2 teams do that on Sunday. First, we'll head to the Panasonic Stadium, where Gunma Osaka notched the first League 3 points of Danny Poyatos' time in charge at Gunma by defeating Kawasaki Frontale 2-0. And, they were absolutely stunning goals as well, Dan. Worthy of the occasion. Gunma sending their fans home happy in the league for the first time this season. And Darwan and Juan Alano certainly lit up the stage.
If you're a Gunma Osaka fan, you're happy with both of those goals. If you're a Kawasaki fan, you're holding your head, because those goals are just totally uncharacteristic for a team that has dominated so much of the last 6 seasons. Obviously, they didn't win last year, but they came very close. Dawan just completely unmarked on that header in the first half. Just inexcusable, but well taken. Fantastic game. Couldn't deserve it more.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. And Sam, Darwin, very happy to have him in my fantasy team. And I probably should celebrate the fact that I've had a good week and actually got the top score, because that probably is the one and only time that'll ever happen. But he came through for me. And Juan Alano certainly did for the Gunma faithful with a screamer early on in the second half to send the Panasonic Stadium into raptures.
Yeah, well, congratulations on your fantasy football performance, and much better than me this week for certain. But yeah, it was terrific. The Alano goal is fantastic. Just cuts inside. Still, from a Frontale perspective, nobody really closes him down. There's not much pressure on the ball, which was kind of a theme of most of this game. You kind of used to Kawasaki really pressing, winning the ball back quickly. They weren't doing that in this game. But Alano, yeah, take nothing away from him. A wonderful strike into the top corner. And it was a really good performance from Gunma. They've had an interesting season so far. They've had a couple of games where they've drawn, but looked like there were certain positive signs, but and then in other games they've completely capitulated. But this time, a lot more solid at the back. They seem to be developing a sort of a brand of football. It's not there yet, and I think this season is still going to be up and down for Gunma, but this is a real step in the right direction. And also, I want to say about Poyatos, I thought after last week, with the way that Tani had a terrible performance against Shonan, I thought he was going to get dropped again. He kept faith with him this time more than he didn't earlier in the season. And I think that was a good decision. I thought Tani had his best game of the year as well.
Yeah, that's a positive sign for Tani that, yeah, the manager kept faith in him. And, yeah, a clean sheet was his manager's reward. And, yeah, I mean, not only two terrific goals, but, yeah, I mean, the second especially was a lovely move, wasn't it? Basically, from right across the pitch, from right to left. And, yeah, Alana with a spectacular second for Gumba. And the what about the Kawasaki fight back then, Sam? Taisei Miyashiro went close. Actually, after both goals, but yeah, wasn't able to hit the target on either occasion. And then they unfortunately lost Shintaro Kurumaya to a pair of yellow cards 8 minutes apart, and he was sent off on the hour. And I guess that kind of put the kibosh on any sort of a real fight back eventuating from Kawasaki. So overall, a bit of a forgettable day, hopefully, for Toru Aniki and his side.
Yeah, very much so. It doesn't help, does it? This is the third time in seven games they've had a defender sent off, and yeah, it worked against Kashima. It actually riled them towards a victory, but there was no such real response here. There were a couple of half chances. There was one where I think it was Miyashiro fired it and he hit Tono and it up off the crossbar. So it wasn't really a designed effort on goal, but that was probably the closest they went. But otherwise, Gamba were pretty comfortable. They put on Leandro Damian, played a bit more direct, but really it was dealt with pretty easily. And you're just watching Kawasaki, and you just think a couple of years ago, the way that they played the ball, it was mesmerising at times, the way they could cut through teams. But yeah, it started maybe last year, and it's carried on definitely into this year. There seems to be no real plan. There seems to be no... They might have possession, but it doesn't ever look like they're going to really cut through a team. And yeah, there are lots of questions to answer at Kawasaki. I don't think at the moment Aniki is in any real threat of his job or anything like that. I won't go that far, but there's definitely things to sort out. It's not just the lack of defenders and constant red cards. There is many things to work on going forward, because it's quite easy to play against Kawasaki at the moment.
Well, yeah, I mean, Dan, we can't talk. Obviously, the team that we support, FC Tokyo, have come nowhere near hitting the heights that Kawasaki have over, as you say, over the last 6 years. And I mean, it's basically an unprecedented run of success, the best there's ever been in J1 history. So I don't think we're sounding the death knell for Frontale as a championship challenger, maybe just yet. It's still only seven games into the season. But, I mean, yeah, there certainly are worrying signs, aren't there? And Sam's mentioned the spate of yellow cards their defenders have gotten. Obviously, yeah, Jeziel's now out of the picture again. And, well, I mean, whether Leandro Damião is going to be able to, yeah, capture or recapture his form of a couple of seasons ago, I guess, is debatable as well, as he works his way back from injury. So as Frontale currently sit down in the 13th spot in the table, will we have to get used to them as a mid-table side for the foreseeable future, do you think?
I don't know if we'll have to get used to it, but things aren't really looking good early, and I think some of that isn't necessarily the club's fault. I mean, there are injuries. Oshima's out again. I forget what he did this time, but he just can't stay healthy to save his life. I think there's a few other injuries. I think Chanatip hasn't really been super healthy. And that happens. But when you look back at the last couple of off seasons for Kawasaki, the signings that they've made in particular, going back to really 2021, when Kaori Mitoma left and Ao Tanaka left, they haven't really been replenishing their stocks. And in 2020, Kawasaki's bench was deep enough that they could survive, you know, a couple players here and there leaving and going to Europe. But over time, that's built up, and Hatate left, and Morita left, and all of these, who else left that I'm thinking of? Taniguchi went to Qatar. Mm-hmm. And you look at how poorly they played defensively over the weekend, and that sort of sums it up. I mean, this defense isn't quite what it used to be. The offense isn't quite what it used to be. I agree with you. I think that Aniki is safe for now, but the mood at Todoroki is not quite that of the dominant champions. And we did see this last Wednesday at the Louvain Cup game, where the home supporters held up banners, basically protesting what they saw as the club's business direction being sort of deviating from what they expected to be. And maybe Kawasaki aren't spending as much time doing sort of community activities in the city of Kawasaki. A lot of front office staff who were key to marketing and building the squad have left and gone on to other things. So it is a period of transition. I don't think that they'll stay in mid-table forever, but this might be part of the rebuilding cycle. I think that we were all very quick to label Kawasaki a dynasty, and just the dynasty may have ended very even faster.
On their recruitment, I mean, even at the start of this year, we delayed our first podcast because it's going to be a preview of Kawasaki and Yokohama, because we just assumed they're going to do something else. They're going to bring in players, considering everyone that they've lost. And they just didn't do that. How much of that do you think is to blame on the manager, in terms of, is he in full control of bringing players in? Or are there other influences, considering most of the money that they brought in for Mitoma and Hatate went on Chanatip? And was that just a business deal, a commercial deal, to really boost their profile in Thailand, more so than maybe an on-field decision?
I would be very wary of calling Chanatip sort of a business decision. I think that really, unless you're getting to players like Iniesta, for example, who although he is still on a good day, a very skilled player. I mean, that was a business decision that paid off for Vissel Kobe. Chanatip was, and still is, a very good player. And I think that they saw him as a way to fill in, you know, a midfield role that they had lost a number of talented players in. It just didn't work. I think he struggled a little to adapt to Kawasaki, and he's had injuries and just a run of things that haven't gone according to plan. But I think that Kawasaki understand that, you know, you can't sign a Southeast Asian player looking to make a splash in that market, and, you know, that's not guaranteed. Look at Tokyo Verity and Arhan. You know, that there was a lot made over that signing, and he's played one game, 45 minutes, nearly a season and a half. So I think that it's still a tough business climate for J-League clubs. I mean, the fans are coming back, the sponsors are back, there's a lot of excitement this season, but it was still sort of difficult for clubs to justify big signings, and we really didn't see too much of that in the offseason from any club. But I think that Kawasaki, Yokohama to an extent, did have a mindset of, well, if it isn't broke, you don't need to make too many adjustments.
Just on the flip side of that, sorry, Ben. In terms of not getting the revenue in, just the pandemic and all that, is there now a feeling within J-League clubs, like, just to see how well their players have done in Europe and the lack of fee that has really been played? I know it's something that fans have griped about, I know I've griped about it a lot, but are the clubs recognising that their assets are worth more and they need to be looking to get more just to help them sustain themselves financially?
I do think that the clubs realize this, and the league realizes this, and this is a conversation that I've had with league officials in the past, and it's come up with some managers I've talked to. I mean, they understand that the business of modern football is selling players. I mean, that is a major thing. Obviously, sponsorship and broadcast revenues and ticket sales are a part of that, but clubs can't survive if their best players are going for, you know, a sandwich and a song. So the question then is, how do you fix it? And that's not something that the league has figured out yet, but they are aware of it. It's just a question of what sort of a solution they'll find. And there are contractual issues that need to be worked out vis-a-vis when you're signing rookies to contracts. How are they structured? Are you putting in sell-on fees? Are you working out things with European clubs? Because obviously, from the European clubs' perspective, they do want to keep good relations with Japanese clubs. Because if they don't, then eventually that will dry up. And there's a lot that needs to be worked on just across the entire structure of how players are signed and how front offices do their business.
All right, terrific stuff. Really appreciate your answers there, Dan. And I tell you what, you mentioned broadcasters there. So before we move on to the next game, we did hear over the course of the last week that DAZN have renewed their deal with the J-League for a further 10 seasons, but worryingly for, roughly a third of the J-League audience, they're not going to be showing J3 games from next season onwards, which for many, many people is a very worrying development. What do you think is behind that? And what sort of a solution will there be for supporters of J3 clubs who obviously want to watch their team on a weekly basis? I don't know if John Steele's going to be calling you for a special appearance on Extra Time later on this week. But in lieu of that, what do you know about the J3 broadcasting situation?
So the J-League, they did announce this deal with DAZN, and it is in effect a second extension because they announced the first extension in 2020, and that was, I believe, supposed to be through 2026. But essentially what they did was financially restructure the deal because of the pandemic, and it did drop the value year by year. But then this new extension brings the value, I think it brings the average year by year value up to what the initial deal was that they signed in 2016. So as far as the J3 is concerned, that was, I believe, the question that got the most discussion during the press conference. And from the league's perspective, they're looking at it as, how do we raise interest in the J3 and give these clubs exposure? And they see alternate paths, and they haven't figured out what those paths are yet, but maybe not putting those games behind the DAZN paywall and creating more flexibility, possibly YouTube broadcasts, maybe the J-League's own OTT service, which has been sort of rumored for quite a long time. I don't know if we're there yet. And also freeing up opportunities for local broadcasters to show games on TV. So that's the strategy they're going for. I think that if you look at the J3, I mean, there's obviously a clear gap between the J3 and the J2 in terms of attendance, in terms of attention, in terms of sponsorship. But the league is now up to 20 clubs, or the division, I should say, and it's grown up. So it's going to take some time, but they do want to create the same local attachment to J3 clubs as there are to J2 and J1 clubs. And this is just what the league thinks is the best way to go about that.
Okay, so it could actually turn out to be a positive for J3 supporters. Their games might not be buried on a DAZN anymore, and yes, they might be some local broadcasters might be able to put their own spin on things, perhaps. So we'll obviously follow that situation down the line, and yes, the Extra Time boys most definitely will as well, I'm sure. So all right then, we took a bit of a tangent there while discussing Gumba's first win of the season. We hope we haven't taken any gloss off that. As we did say, there were excellent goals from Darwin and Juan Alano, and full credit to Gumba for an excellent performance, and yes, their first 3 points of the season. Also tasting success in the league for the first time this year were Kashiwa Reysol in the late game on Sunday at Hitachi Dai. They hosted Kashima Antlers and, a very familiar combination, Sam, of Mateus Savio and Mal Hosoya provided all the ammunition that Reysol would need. The hosts winning 1-0 thanks to a 32nd-minute strike from Hosoya after he raced on to a lovely weighted through ball from Savio and did the rest.
Yeah, it was a rare bit of good play in this game, and it was I was quite miserable watching this because it was like 9 hours into my shift after starting at 3 a.m. and I might be too harsh on this game maybe, but I thought it was quite dreadful. But this was a good piece of play, and we've wanted to see this from Cachoeira all season. They've not really been able to link up too well, but this is a lovely through ball, and Hosoya takes his goal really well, and Cachoeira just about deserved it. I thought though there was very little in this like race, or besides this, they were trying a little bit more to play more progressive football because they'd resorted in the last few weeks to just lumping the ball a little bit more. So they tried a bit more here. Nothing really came off for them, but they were probably just about the better team. Cachoeira had possession, but were just so dull. They just launched balls aimlessly towards Suzuki and hope he can nod it down to someone. If not, they'll play it very slowly and go wide and play in a cross, which again is fairly easy to defend against. And this is against a Raysol team whose defence has been so poor this season. Every team that's come up against them has been able to create problems for them, create chances, and this Cachoeira team didn't. And I mean, yeah, it's a really poor display from them. It's another one this season. They've barely really turned up again. They were really poor at the end of last year under Iwamasa. I don't see them improving this year. And you just see the players that they've got, the quality that's in that squad, and to put in a performance like that against a team that's been as poor as Cachoeira, I think is an embarrassment.
Yeah, definitely a collector's item this season, a Cachoeira Raysol clean sheet, Dan. And yeah, from the highlights, I mean, there are a couple of chances either side of halftime for Antlers. Yuma Suzuki's low shot was superbly kept out by Kenta Matsumoto. I nearly said Kenta Hasegawa then. And just after the break, Kolki Anzai screwed a shot across the face of goal, just missing Matsumoto's far post. But yeah, apart from that, there wasn't a lot to speak of from Antlers. And yeah, Suzuki was hooked 15 minutes from time and had to watch on as his side sputtered to the finish line and were unable to break down this very forgiving Raysol defence, who actually stood firm for a change. And just like at Frontale, I think these are definitely worrying times for Cachoeira Antlers, aren't they, as they sit a point and a place worse off than Frontale in the table.
Before I get into that, I want to add to what Sam has said. I brought up the highlights just as we're recording now, just to look at the goal again. I noticed that the highlights on the J-League channel jump from the 55th minute straight to the 94th, which sort of tells you everything you need to know about how little there was in this game.
Yeah.
It's not looking good I think that Cachoeira are good enough to stay out of the relegation zone, even though Nelsinho seems to be fighting back a bit against some supporters. They had a banner of some sort that he got angry about. I think it might have been midweek or even last weekend. Antlers, though, I don't think Antlers will be relegated, but boy, what a mess under Iwamasa. I do not think he is going to survive the season, if we're being honest. Just they've completely lost their way.
Yeah, we've obviously already had a couple of managerial casualties in J2, and we wonder how long it will be before somebody gets the axe in J1. And if you're a betting man, Daiki Iwamasa would probably be the short price favorite to be the first manager sacked. Again, we're not trying to take anything away from Raysol, their first victory of the season. So Gumba and Cachoeira winning for the first time. They stayed in the bottom three after these wins, but that leaves just one team yet to taste success in the league in J1 in 2023, and that is Yokohama FC. And Dan, you were at the Nissan Stadium on Saturday night. This game had the Saturday stage all to itself. F Marinos hosted Yokohama FC in the Yokohama Derby. The sides reached the interval level, but once Takuya Wana had his pocket picked just outside the box 2 minutes into the second half, and Marcos Junior finished with a minimum of fuss, it's fair to say the floodgates opened, Dan.
Yeah, you have to give Yokohama FC credit to play in a derby away, and they did put up a good fight, and I think Marinos were pretty frustrated with their first half performance. I mean, they were giving away the ball quite a bit unnecessarily in the Yokohama FC half, and Kevin Muscat did talk a lot about that post game. But once they scored that goal, I think we expected FC to maybe park the bus a little and try to keep the damage down, or just minimize the impact on their goal difference. But they did not, and they paid quite dearly for it. There were just a lot of solid goals by Marinos, but Yokohama FC, they're not good. Not good at all.
Yeah, I mean, the heavens opened for most of this game. And yes, as we said, Sam, the floodgates opened after Marcos Junior's goal early on in the second half. A burst of three in 11 minutes from firstly from Anderson Lopez, and then a brace from El Burr before Lopez finished off the scoring with the fifth in the 90th minute. So, what if any positives can Yokohama FC take out of this game? The first half, they were able to keep scoreless, and it sounded like it was a fairly even affair to that point. But, should they have done better at limiting the damage? It sounds like they were really the architects of their own demise, especially once Lopez first went in just past the hour.
Yeah, I thought, to be honest, first half, I think, was probably their best performance of the season, best half of the season. I think Marinos had the ball in the net through an offside goal early, and then Ondoka had cleared one off the line towards the end of the half. Mm-hmm. But between that, I thought Yokohama FC were maybe the more progressive, the team more likely to score. I mean, you look at the highlights and it skips between the two events that I just mentioned, but they didn't really create a clear-cut chance or anything, but they looked decent. They got in down the left-hand side, Marinos left through Kondo a couple of times, gave Nagata one of his most difficult halves of football, and they looked pretty decent. But yeah, it was as soon as they made that mistake through Wado, who's had a terrible season, they just lost all defensive discipline. You've got to keep, once you go 1-0 down, just keep it tight for a little bit, have that about you, and then look to go in a little bit later in the game and push. But yeah, it was just, they lost their minds, I think. They just wanted to attack. They went forward far too much, in my opinion, but in terms of the leaving gaps at the back, and then the defence was just so passive. I mean, some of the move for the second goal is really nice from Marinos. It's typical of what you imagine a Marinos goal to look like, but it was like against training cones. They were just there in spirit, the defenders, without really putting in any sort of foot in or anything like that. And yeah, once it was 2-0, it became 3-0, 4-0, 5-0 really easily. The fifth goal, terrible goalkeeping. I described it as biscuit wrists on Twitter, because that was what it was. It was just so weak. And yeah, they've got so many things to work on. And it's so difficult to see this defense and really being able to survive. I mean, yes, it's only one team down, and that's the only thing that might be saving them at the moment. But yeah, once you take Koki Ogawa out of the team, there's really such a lack of quality as well. You look at, because they've made so many signings and they've got such a young team as well. So you look at it and who's going to stand up for them? And you expect Wada to be one of those as an experienced professional. Mita's also in there, but he kind of gets lost in the shuffle in midfield. And besides that, they're really struggling for any quality. And it really got exposed in the second half.
Indeed. So yeah, the conditions weren't great. Dan, you had to deal with some fairly unseasonable cool weather. It had been quite warm, hadn't it? But yes, the weather definitely took a turn for the worse on Saturday. And that definitely affected the crowd number on Saturday night, with just over 25,000 there on a nicer evening. The clubs probably would have drawn closer to 35, I would have guessed. But I reckon the weather will have kept some casuals away. But anyway, Nissan Stadium on a Saturday night. What did you make of the atmosphere at the ground? And obviously, yeah, you have been busy at times throughout this year with figure skating and other responsibilities in your job with the Japan Times. But yeah, what have you made of the atmospheres at the grounds that you've been to this season? Are they back to pre-pandemic levels? I mean, I asked Chris of J League Journeys a similar question last week, and he was rapturous about the difference. Have you noticed it especially as well?
Yeah, I will say I was very disappointed with the turnout at Nissan. I think if they had managed to do that as a 2 p.m. kickoff, you probably would have avoided the worst of the rain and probably could have hit 30,000 at least. Marino supporters looked great. Yokohama FC supporters were there. Loud at times, but the vibe was pretty good for a very poor conditions. I think if you're grading it on that curve, especially with the wind picking up and doing things with the rain, so that, you know, even if you're under the roof, you're not totally safe. Great energy. And I've seen that at other stadiums too this season, at Ajinomoto, at Todoroki, at the National Stadium. J-League atmospheres are back. Looking, even watching on TV, just night and day, just seeing supporters group together, seeing everyone cheering, not as many masks. I think that there are still some people who are hesitant. And overall, if you look at the attendance, it's up. I haven't actually checked after Sunday, but I'm going to do a sneaky check right now and try to find the average attendance as it stands. But I think it's at 16 or 17,000 a game, which is up about 2,000 or 3,000 from last season as it stands. So over the course of the year, I think the number is going to improve. I don't know if we're going to hit the 20,000 that we were at in 2019, but yeah, things are great. It really does feel like we're back to the old times.
And that also means that, supporters of clubs can I guess, air their grievances as well, as we've talked about in the green room. And you mentioned with possibly a banner that Nel Senior wasn't happy with at Kashiwa. And, I think the natives are definitely getting restless at Kashima with their manager, Daiki Iwamasa, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think Kashima fans a week or two ago blocked the team bus for an hour. I think it was after the Hiroshima game, if I'm not mistaken. Things are when Antlers fans get restless, they get restless, and that's an issue. I think as I talked about earlier with the Kawasaki banner, that's one of the great things about the J-League, is that yes, the fans are nice, the fans are much less radical, let's say, than, you know, in European leagues, but when they get upset, they do show it. There was even an incident at the Nagoya Urawa game over the weekend. I saw, I think, something about an Urawa fan who headbutted a security guard. So, you know, nature's healing. It's we're getting back to normal, guys. It's
I don't know anything to add on that, Sam, but from the guests we've spoken to this season, it does sound like the atmospheres are back to normal in more ways than one.
Yeah, you can definitely just sense it even here a few thousand miles away, just watching the games on the computer screens. It's definitely great to have that sort of atmosphere back. And I'm going to try and go lean this into another tangent. Sorry if I'm taking you here, there and everywhere, Dan, but while we're on Marinos, while we're on good attendances, hopefully. There's a window coming up in July where previously European clubs have come on and toured. Can we be expecting a Yokohama F. Marinos versus Celtic game maybe in that period? And have you heard of any other clubs that might be looking to play J-League sides over that window?
So it isn't official yet. I think that a Celtic tour of Japan this summer is in many ways one of the biggest... it's an open secret at this point. And we generally accept that. I think one of the games will be against Marinos, and they might have one or two other games, TBD, possibly against, I think we all expect them to play Vissel Kobe so that Furuhashi can get his homecoming. Who knows if there will be a third or who that will be against. The other rumor that is out there and is also sort of an open secret is Manchester City will be back in town as part of the J-League Challenge, which they also participated in 2019. And they will again play Marinos, who I believe they played. Was it 2019? I believe it was 2019.
Yeah, so at the same time Chelsea came over.
Right, because Chelsea came and they played Barcelona and did the other thing, and play Kawasaki, if I'm not mistaken. So those two, Bayern Munich, are rumored. I'm hearing it's a go. I don't have 100% on that yet, but I'm pretty sure it's a go. There's rumors that PSG are considering another Japan tour. Seems excessive. I mean, they did set, what was it? They set a single day merchandise record at their friendlies last summer. I think they moved $1 million in merchandise, which was a record. And think about that record during even surpassing like the Rugby World Cup and games like that. So if PSG want to come, they'll sell out. I think that's a foregone conclusion, but I think that depends on how their season finishes up and what their summer schedule will be like. And what else is, I'm trying to think if I've missed anything else. There was a Brighton rumor going about, but they would not be able to play a J-League club because the rumor is that they were going to come in early June after the Premier League season wraps up. But the J1 would still be ongoing. So there's some rumor about them playing, I think, a German club. It might have been Stuttgart, might have been someone else. I don't see it. I don't think it's going to happen. So I think those are the big three that we're expecting. Celtic, Man City, Bayern, PSG's a maybe, and there might be someone else in the mix. Who knows?
All right. Well, surely Real Sociedad will come over and play FC Tokyo. So, Tokyo supporters can catch up with Takefusa Kubo. But we'll watch this space and see what happens. So, speaking of Tokyo, as I attempt to segue somewhat awkwardly there with my Kubo reference, we'll finish up our chat on the four games we're going to cover with you in part one, Dan, by talking about FC Tokyo's 2-2 draw at home against Shonan on Sunday afternoon. I don't know. Houston, do we have a problem here? I'm a little bit disappointed with the way things are progressing, or rather not really progressing under Albert Pucci in season two. I know we're only seven games in to the second season, Dan, and yes, patience is a virtue, but I don't know. After basically Jakub Slavik handed the 3 points to Tosu in last week's game, while he made a number of astonishing saves in this game, he played a huge part in Shonan's equaliser here after Terohito Nakagawa had given Tokyo the lead on the half hour. A horrible clearance from a horribly misplaced pass out from the back by Slavik presented Shonan with a chance that Slavik tipped over, but from the resulting corner, Shonan were able to score. And then, shortly after, it was two goals in 5 minutes when Tariq El-Yunusi made it 2-1 just before the hour. And, Tokyo needed a 65th-minute equaliser from Henrique Trevisan, who were headed in across from Adailton to rescue a point. So, Tokyo were firmly sat in mid-table, well adrift now of the leading bunch, and recent performances are not really sparking much confidence in me that they'll be pushing up the table anytime soon.
I'll tell you, you know who their Tokyo special guest was at that game was a Kazuchika Okada, a major New Japan pro wrestling star, but should have been Marie Kondo, because, man, that was messy. They need some KonMari over at Ajinomoto, because that was a sloppy game. And I'm still liking Nakagawa. I think that he was a great signing. I think that that was good, but what was the defense doing on those Belmare goals? Just the shambles. And as to your point on how much we should be worrying, I don't know. It's a long season. I mean, I can still say that now. We're only however many rounds in. I think we're only seven rounds in. I mean, there's still a few, 4/5 of the season left to play, give or take, you know, a little less, but plenty of time. And yet, I don't know. I think that we had expected things to come together a little more, but eighth in the table at this point, you're 7 points back on first, but I don't think that Kobe can stay up there forever. It's a long season. You're just aiming to, by round 10 or 11, you know, you want to be hitting those notes consistently. And I think there's still time before you hit the panic button, but Albert knows what he's doing, or he thinks he does. And I would give him more leeway than I would some other coaches who might be in a similar position.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not hitting the panic button, but I mean, yeah. I mean, the last three games, Sam, have been really frustrating. No wins. Well, yeah, obviously it should have been a draw last week, but for Slovic's meltdown. I don't know. I'm not sure he knows his first choice defense. Obviously, now Kashif Bangunagande had gotten injured on international duty, so that's necessitated some changes. And well, yeah, I mean, Slovic, without some of his astonishing saves in this game, I mean, Belmare could have come close or even bettered the huge score they put up against Gumba last week.
Yeah, I thought he did well to bail himself out of various issues. But yeah, it's been interesting the last few weeks with Tokyo. It just seems like this was meant to be the year that Tokyo went on to challenge for the top four. And it seems like you're still stuck in another little transitional period. As you mentioned, defence, Morishige, is he going to start? Is he not? That he's been in and out. Nagatomo, likewise, not settled on a midfield. Yes, there have been injuries in there. They're still trying to blood youngsters as well at this stage, which is not a terrible thing. But you think maybe that could have been done last year if this was going to be the year that Tokyo really moved on. So, yeah, not great. Defensively, I thought, woeful. I mean, there was a lot of things wrong with the Belmare equaliser, mainly the camera missing it, so we didn't actually see it.
Right,
But Tokyo's defence were also, I think they must have been watching the replay and not realising that a corner was being taken, because nobody went out, nobody noticed, and it's a really easy goal for Shonan to score. So, yeah, defensively there are definitely issues. Slovic's kicking and distribution is a major issue. This is 2 weeks in a row. His goal kicks, there's no pressure on him with the balls that he's playing out, and to get it as wrong as he is really poor. And yeah, there's only so many times he can bail them out, because he definitely didn't last week with his attempted save from Kawata. So yeah, disappointing, but I do want to be positive about Shonan. I thought they played really well. I think this season they seem to have gone up a gear, where you've generally been that team that have been a yo-yo between J1 and J2 to becoming one that's perilously on the edge of being relegated. But this year, they seem to have a bit more confidence about them. They seem to be more progressive with the way they play. I think a lot comes down to how good Machino is and the way they can build off him. And they've just got confidence around him. So I thought they did really well to get back into this game. They looked a decent side. But yeah, Tokyo, still a work in progress at the moment for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, you set me up for a nice segue there, Sam, because we had a question off Patreon from Jonathan, who's a Belmare supporter. And we might actually tie Brett's question in here as well, Dan. And don't worry, Sam, I'll check with you before we let Dan go if there's anything else you want to throw at him. But yeah, Jonathan says, well, basically he's a nervous Belmare supporter. He's worried that Shuto Machino might be potentially moving to Europe in the summer, and wondering if you've heard anything about that, any rumblings about where Machino might be heading. And also Brett, on a slightly broader kind of a topic, wondering if you've heard of any players who are currently Japanese players currently in Europe who might be changing clubs in this this coming summer transfer window. He mentions Daichi Kamada, who is the obvious one because he's a free agent. But yeah, do you think there are or have you heard of any others that might seek a move to a different side? Brett asks.
As far as Machino is concerned, I haven't seen any rumors specifically about Machino. I think it's a little too early for the summer silly season to hit us quite yet. But if I'm a betting man and you're asking me if Machino is going to last the year, I don't think I'm taking that bet. I think that he's, you know, but especially by getting onto the Japan squad or getting call up and, you know, getting his name out there, I think he's put European clubs on notice, and I think he's one of the few who are left in Japan's World Cup squad who aren't going to end up in a European club at some point. So I think it'll happen. It's just a question of when. But I wouldn't be optimistic in Shonan's chances of holding on to him through the summer. As for other players that I'm keeping an eye on for moves, I don't think that Celtic can hold on to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've got five Japanese players there. Kyogo Furuhashi is easily the top performer among Japanese players in Europe. Well, him and, I mean, I shouldn't say easily the top, but among the top, if you're including Mitoma. And I think that a lot of clubs are going to come calling this summer, and one of them may come up with an offer that Celtic can't refuse. I think him and Hatate have to be really big targets. And I'm sure that Brighton would love to keep Mitoma for at least another season. But I'm sure that he's going to get some offers that they might have trouble refusing. I think those are the big ones. I'm also looking at sort of not quite fringy players like Keito Nakamura. Is he ready for a step up from Austria? This might be the summer to do it. I think that this is going to be a big year, especially going into World Cup qualifying for the younger players who are going to be eligible for Paris next year. So assuming that Japan do qualify for the Olympics, they all want to show their stuff. So I think it's going to be one or two big moves among Japanese players. You mentioned Kamada. He's obviously, his move to Dortmund is sort of, people are reporting it as a done deal, but we'll see how that goes in practice. And a lot of weird trends. I think there's going to be a lot of interesting transitional moves. I'm not sure that there are really many huge Japan to Europe moves that we'll see this summer. I think Machino could be one of them. I think Kuryu Matsuki could be one of them. So we'll have to wait and see how that all plays out.
All right, then. Okay. Terrific stuff, Dan. All right. So, yeah, Sam, was there anything else you wanted to have Dan deal with before we let him get on with the rest of his Monday evening?
Yeah, sorry, Dan. I just wanted to kind of link the last question with my question on just kind of to bring us up to date with how the national team is going to be, like what sort of games are coming up for them a bit prior to the World Cup qualifiers. But just on the players there, and Hatate and Furuhashi specifically, do you think if they are left out of the next squad in June, that might kind of ramp up their desire maybe to move away from Celtic if the manager is not going to call them up necessarily? If they're at Celtic, do you think an omission there might push them more towards the Premier League or the Bundesliga?
I know that people will listen to me answer this question and come up with their own conclusions. I mean, I think that they both want to play for the national team. I don't think that either of them is sort of a Yuma Suzuki-esque, you know, thing going. I don't think that they want to pull the pin and self-destruct in that aspect, but you look at how well they're playing for Celtic, and you have to look at the circumstances at that club. And yes, there are some things that they can still do at Celtic that they haven't done yet. Go further in the Champions League, maybe. I think the treble is still in play for them to clinch this. You know, there's much that they can do, but you know, if Liverpool, if Man United, if Tottenham come calling, those are just three clubs I've named just as examples. It is really hard to say no to that. If your goal is to play at the highest level, which I think everyone can agree that the Premier League is. So, you know, do they want to make the national team? Yes, but they also want to play the best football that they can play. And I think that has to be the priority. And if they can do that, then the national team call-ups will come.
Mm. Rightio then. Okay. So, yeah. So to the national team aspect of things then, Dan. So what do we know about what's coming up, as Sam said before, the World Cup qualifiers get going?
So we have 6 friendlies left before World Cup qualifiers, the JFA did us the favor of announcing them at the beginning of the year, so we do know where they will be. Let's see, June 15th at Toyota Stadium, June 20th at Suita Stadium, so sort of Chubu Kansai swing. In September, they'll be playing both games in Europe, and we have no idea where. I think you can probably assume that they might be playing in Germany, as they have in the past, or in Belgium, as they have in the past. They may, in fact, play Germany again. I think there was talk about having a friendly between those two sides to sort of recapture the magic of that World Cup game. And then in October, they are booked for Niigata Denki Swan Stadium and Noavir Stadium in Kobe. So that's October 13th and 17th, respectively. And then there will be a home World Cup qualifier at Suita on November 16th. And then the 21st is to be decided. I think that's going to be an away game, or should be an away game. So basically, if you're in Tokyo and you want to see the national team, you've got to travel a bit. Is the message here. But there are, you know, big stadiums. I'm sure there'll be plenty of opportunities to get tickets, even though the last two games were both wildly sold out. So speaking of atmospheres being back, I think, you know, the World Cup did do a lot to create some buzz around this national team. And, you know, with the, I want to say the pandemic's over, but the fact that fans can come back and cheer is going to, you know, make those crowds a little livelier.
Are there any rumoured opponents? I know personally I would like, I know there's not many options available necessarily with European clubs tied up, but World Cup winning Argentina side, any chance that they might arrive?
You know what, there was a rumour that was going to happen in March.
Mm.
And it didn't make sense at the time because I think Argentina wanted to play their first post-World Cup friendlies in front of a home crowd as they deserve to. That could happen. I haven't heard much on that front, but I think that Japan showed at this World Cup that, you know, they deserve to be taken seriously, and I think that they certainly have the star power to draw some marquee opponents. But also offhand, I don't quite know the all the nations leagues that are happening and the friendly schedules in other continents, so that might be a bit of a messy thing to work around. But Argentina could happen. I do think that if they want to play European teams, they're gonna have to do it in Europe. But you know, I think we're gonna still see a lot of, you know, big South American clubs, maybe North American clubs, or sorry, I should say teams, not clubs. You know, we'll see how it goes.
Yep, interesting stuff. All right, Dan. Well, I think we've kept you for long enough. It's always great to catch up with you and get your thoughts, obviously, not only on the action on the pitch, but obviously always so much happening off it as well in J-League and Samurai Blue circles. So, thanks for popping on, and we look forward to catching up with you again soon and indeed throughout the 2023 season.
Absolutely, always a pleasure. I've got some. I know them. I am back on the figure skating beat this weekend, but I'm working on some super cool content ahead of the J League's 30th anniversary celebrations. So yeah, it's a bit of a tease. I mean, we'll hopefully all be out in another month or so, but look forward to that.
Outstanding. So, yes, as always, you can catch Dan's work in the Japan Times, and you can follow him on Twitter at Aishiteru Tokyo, but you're probably doing that already, listeners. All right, thanks again to Dan. After a quick hit of music, Sam and I will wrap up the other five games from J1 Match Day 7. Welcome back. And in part one, we spent quite a bit of time down at the foot of J1, Sam, and in mid-table in the cases of Shonan and FC Tokyo. Let's go right up to the sharp end of the top flight table and chat about the leaders, Vissel Kobe. They remained on top of the pile despite a 0-0 home draw against Niigata in, yes, one of the games we picked out that would be worth watching over the weekend. Shots were fairly even here. The visitors, Albirex, were much ahead in the possession statistic, but I think we can agree that Vissel had the better chances throughout the 90 minutes, and indeed even thought they'd won it in the 95th when Mr. Late Show John Patrick raced through and finished past Ryosuke Kojima, only for VAR to intervene after about a 2-minute check that Yuya Osako had been offside in the build-up.
Yeah, so eventually the correct decision. The ball's headed forward and Osako's coming from an offside position to nod it on. And there is eventually a replay with the lines out, so it's kind of Osako's backside, which is offside. So unfortunate for Kobe. But it would have been harsh on Niigata if they'd have lost, I thought. And it very harsh just for the way it would have come out as well, with two defenders crashing into each other. It was just completely against how they defended throughout the game. I thought both teams defensively, and it's so rare in this league for this game and the next one to show two defences that actually turned up and looked decent. And that's kind of what kept Kobe at bay in the main. There was maybe the best chance went to Yoshinori Muto, a terrific run that he made. But again, in front of goal, this is, it's not quite been there, and he dragged his shot wide. That was probably the best effort. Kojima back in goal made a decent save from Yuriki, and otherwise nothing else major for Kobe. Niigata kind of were restricted to long range efforts. I mean, Thomas Deng almost scored goal of the century from 45 yards there with an absolute pile driver that went just over. But yeah, Michael was really well protected by that Kobe defence, which I still can't believe I'm saying this is considering Kobe defences of every other year. But yeah, it was an interesting game, but 0-0, I think just about fair. And I think, yeah, it'd have been harsh if Kobe had nicked it right at the end.
Yeah, is this another indication that that Niigata firmly belong at this level, Sam? Because they'd had a couple of losses on the spin coming in, and I don't know, maybe some of the shine had slightly come off their excellent start to the season. But yeah, the fact that they were able to go away to the leaders and yeah, not sparkle as they have done at times going forward this campaign, but show there is some rigidity to their back line as well, I guess, is yeah, they're gradually adding that feather to their bow as well.
Yeah, they are, and I think it helps that they've got a few players back here. They were closer towards their main starting 11, Horigome back and Deng back at the centre back, still missing what James was suspended or Fitzgerald, and Chiba still injured, but they're getting better there. And Takahiro Ko, I think, is so vital to them. He'd not started the last four in all competitions, but getting him in front of that defence, I think he brings a real a presence in there, a real calming presence, just to keep the ball and start off the Niigata attacks, as well as a real that shielding position in front of the defence. So that gave them the base to work on, and yeah, they looked pretty decent going forward. They've been better in other games, but yeah, once they get that base settled and then they're allowing to spring, I think, yeah, that we'll see a bit more of the best of Niigata. But this was a really positive defensive display, which it hasn't always been the case this year.
All right then. So yeah, that was my pick of Sunday in last week's episode. Sam's pick was the clash between the then teams in the second and third in the table, and Nagoya hosting Urawa. Reds have slipped a couple of spots in the table behind teams who won over the weekend, including F. Marinos, who we've already talked about. But yeah, this game also ended 0-0, and we had the odd situation, Sam, of Kasper Juncker, who was on loan from Urawa, able to play for Nagoya with apparently the terms of his loan stating that, yes, he's okay to play against Urawa at the Toyota Stadium, but when Reds are at home at Saitama later on in the season, he will be ineligible. So have you ever heard of any sort of a loan agreement like that before? Because I certainly haven't.
No, I haven't. It's kind of ridiculous to me. And I'll just start with a public apology to anyone that changed fantasy football teams or anything like that by listening to my nonsense last week that thought that Juncker was out. I thought that Reds were a competently run team that would have stopped one of their Nagoya's best players playing against them when they had the opportunity, like everyone else does, through loan deals. But no, I suppose Juncker didn't play too well, so maybe that was also in the fine print of the deal that he is not allowed to turn up and play particularly well. But yeah, really weird situation, and no, I've never seen that from any other loan deal. It's usually cut and dry. You can't play against your parent club in any fixture. So yeah, really weird situation. But yeah, they, at least for Reds, they weren't punished by that. I thought Nagoya were the better side. They had the better chances. Nagai missed a couple. Mateus, who is still getting towards form, was better in this game. But yeah, he had the best chance of the game as the ball kind of dropped quite fortuitously to him. But then he's one-on-one with the goalkeeper, puts it wide, and any other season he'd have scored that. But again, both defences were really good. The Reds have been improving going forward this season, but came up against a Nagoya side that really didn't offer them too much space, too much time. And if they did get past, Langerak was very capable to deal with all of them. And Reds, likewise, other than being a cut apart a couple of times and sort of somewhat fortuitously in the way that they were pretty solid as well. So yeah, it was two good teams that came up against each other, and it was an interesting 0-0, but a 0-0 all the same.
Yeah, so we missed the target with our picks in last week's episode, but as you say, they were both interesting games in their own right for nil-nils. We've certainly had some dire ones over the years in J1, and they don't think either of these games fit into that category. But I guess with Grampus, they have to take the good with the bad with Kensuke Nagai, don't they? I certainly have enough experience as an FC Tokyo supporter of watching Nagai miss the target when it seems easier to do otherwise over the last few years. And yes, that chance for Mateus in the 72nd minute, I mean, you just expect him to eat those for breakfast. But still unable to still hasn't broken his duck in the league in 2023. I guess as long as I keep mentioning it, it'll probably keep continuing. I thought it would have double jinxed it by now, but he fired wide of Shusaku Nishikawa's right hand post, and yes, Nishikawa in a terrific form again between the sticks for Reds. So after these two games ended goalless, Kobe and Nagoya still have the joint best defense in J1, having conceded just two goals from their seven games so far. And yes, one of those we have certainly grown to count on over the last few seasons in Nagoya. But as you said, Sam, a number of times in recent weeks, yes, Kobe still missing key personnel. It's a real credit to their organization, their coaching staff, that they've still conceded just the two goals through seven games and continue to top the pile. Well, with those two teams dropping points, and indeed, as I said, Reds dropping a couple of spots in the table down to sixth, a couple of teams from the West took advantage and moved up into joint third in the table with identical records after seven match days, including, yes, the same amount of goals scored and conceded. They are Sanfrecce Hiroshima and Avispa Fukuoka. We'll cover Avispa first. And, I hope I'm not flogging your dead horse here, Avispa fans. But again, your attendance left a lot to be desired on a glorious Sunday afternoon at the Best Denki Stadium. Just over 6,300 saw their team come from behind to beat Kyoto 2-1. I don't know what Avispa have to do, Sam, to draw some more fans in. They've left it late and provided great entertainment for the fans that did turn up. Hopefully they'll have a bring a friend week the next time that Avispa are at home, and some more people in the greater Fukuoka area can experience and Avispa game, because they have been keeping it exciting. There's no doubt about that. Patrick gave Kyoto the lead 11 minutes into the second half, when he did superbly to steer home from 6 yards when Kyo Sato's cross from the left flicked off a player in the center. Patrick kept his concentration and, as I said, did superbly to finish from close range. But then Lukian equalized from the penalty spot in the 78th minute. And one of the prodigal sons of the J-League, Wellington, he's been here, there and everywhere. And in his second spell with Avispa now, he scored his first goal of his second stint down in Fukuoka by powering home a header from a corner 4 minutes after Lukian's equaliser. So, Fukuoka turning the tables on Kyoto, but it did take a save from Takumi Nagaishi deep into second half stoppage time. Indeed, right near the end of the sixth of six second half stoppage time minutes when Yuta Toyokawa's shot looked goal bound, but a terrific save from Nagaishi kept it out. So, Fukuoka, the good times continue to roll as they, as I said, Sam, they fly high up in joint third.
They do, and Daniel wants me to be positive about them. And I mean, third is a good position. They're defensively very good. They've been able to flick on a switch whenever going 1-0 down, and then they look like they can attack and they look like they can cause problems. The only problem is that it's often they have to go 1-0 down before they come out and attack. And it's just, I think I would like it more. I think Avispa fans, they might get more supported out there if Avispa look to be more progressive from the off instead of starting off with the thinking 0-0 is quite a good result and we'll go from there. And so it's just slightly frustrating to me that they can switch on a flicker switch and become a more exciting team, because until the Kyoto goal, this was quite a dull affair, which I think is really what Avispa games are until something happens out of the blue. And I don't know if that's affecting the attendances or not, but it's certainly stopping me from being overly enthusiastic about Avispa, because they are just about scraping past a couple of tight games at the moment. But I think eventually the way that they play, and they're always looking for a draw, better teams are going to start coming to Avispa and start taking the points. Because, I think the two games that you've mentioned in terms of the attendance, is this one is Kyoto, which, with all the greatest respect to Kyoto, is not a marquee fixture. The previous one was Yokohama FC, again, not a marquee fixture. So maybe once, I don't know, Yokohama, if Marinos come to town, maybe that will kind of instill a little bit more excitement among Fukuoka supporters. Because this game, it sparked into life, but both teams were quite content to just kind of knock it around and not really take too many risks. So, just trying to be positive, But, I'm still not there. I think it's great for them. But I like Avispa as a club. They were one of my first teams in J2, so I'll always have a soft spot for them. And third is fantastic for them. I think the aim is not to get relegated, and to have a 12-point gap is fantastic for them. And I don't see them changing the way that they are going to approach games, because a team that can defend in this league is like so rare this season, and it's going to help them get points. And I think they'll do well on that. They're not an exciting team for me to watch. I can't lie about that. I can't say I really look forward to an Avispa game, but it is working for them, so you've got to give them credit for that. So good result for them. I just wish the last 15 minutes or so was what we'd see from Avispa throughout the season and throughout games.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. Okay. Don't think it's unreasonable to ask for a little bit more proactive football, as you say, before they fall behind. So, but they have and they do deserve enormous credit for, fighting back in games. And, this was just the latest example as they carry on the longest unbeaten run in J1 this season. Yes, since losing on the opening day, there are 6 unbeaten, and no other team has matched that so far this season. Obviously, we're only 7 games in. So, a trio of Brazilians scoring the goal the goals in that game. And Hiroshima's hero from last week away at Kashima was at it again at home, this time against Tosu. Douglas Vieira, of course, Chris and Lolo's new best mate. He came off the bench just before the hour with the this game also knotted at 0-0 after Rapakil Gyu had made a number of first half saves to deny, among others, Nassim Ben Khalifa, Gakuto Notsuda, and Makoto Mitsuta. But yes, Vieira only needed 15 or 16 minutes this time before, yes, his presence on the pitch paid off. He took a lovely ball in from Shunki Higashi after some suffocating pressing from the front from Hiroshima, won the ball back about 25 yards from goal. And from, just inside the box, Vieira finished in off Park for the only goal of the game as, Hiroshima joined Avispa in a joint third with 14 points, the same as Nagoya, 2 points behind Vissel Kobe. And, this looked a pretty cut and dried 1-0, Sam. Tosu looked like they were suffocated for the most part as, Hiroshima look back to their effective pressing best for the most part here.
Yeah, it was another kind of battering 1-0 victory for them. They just, if they had a 15-goal season striker, then I think I'd nail them down to win the title. But they don't have that, so they have to create a lot of chances before they score goals. It doesn't help that poor Kawamura has, I don't know what he's done to the officials this season, but there was another goal that he had disallowed where ball drops to him at the edge of the area and the referee blows for a foul just as he shoots. He scores. It then doesn't count and they have to take a free kick. So, yeah, poor guy. It's not working out for him. But, yeah, just otherwise, Hiroshima were completely on top. Park had to make a number of saves, but with Ben Khalifa up front, it doesn't fill me with confidence that he's going to score many times when he takes his shot. And Douglas Vieira is in this kind of little purple patch over a couple of games, but with his fitness record and just his general record, he's never really been a major goal scorer. So I'm not sure he's the prodigal son or anything. I don't think he's going to be the answer to it, but they just need to find a way of scoring a few more goals. They got a morale boost in like 5-0 win against Kobe's reserves in midweek, and they finally put Mitsuta back into its attacking midfield position, which stayed for this game, which is a positive. And you saw the amount of chances they created. They're just that clinical goal scorer away from being like more of the complete article. But yeah, they were really good. Sagan Tosu were lifeless, really. I mean, they're not bad, like, in terms of possession. They can play good football. They can get to a certain part of the pitch, but there's nobody to put the ball in the back of the net. They do not look threatening at all. And, in another season, you might be more worried about Tosu, but I think they've still just about got enough to survive. But I'm just going to segue onto one of Daniel's questions. He had a few here, and he says, with Kobe, Nagoya, Avispa and Hiroshima filling the top four spots, do you think Japanese football has moved west? Obviously not quite as west as Tosu, but yeah, do you think there has been that shift away from those Kanto clubs and their dominance, especially Marinos and Frontale from the last few seasons?
Well, yeah, as we spoke about right back at the start of the episode, with Frontale and Antlers, two absolute giants of J1, struggling down in the bottom six after seven games. Those two clubs have certainly gotten off to very rough starts. But with Marinos lurking in fifth and Reds third at the start of this match day, obviously, and slipping, as I said, a couple of spots after their draw with the likes of Hiroshima and Avispa moving above them. I think it's perhaps a little bit premature, but it's definitely an interesting development in this season. We've gotten used to, obviously, Kawasaki being top or right up there at the sharp end, and F Marinos for the most part have been the same over the course of the last five seasons. And I would expect them to still be in the title shakeup at the end of the season. But it's always interesting to see which unfancied club will rise the highest in the early going and whether they can stick it out. And I think Fukuoka have been a bit of a yo-yo team over the course of the last couple of seasons, haven't they, Sam? And you've obviously just said your piece on them. But yeah, after coming back into J1 and doing so well a couple of seasons ago, then finding their second season a bit of a struggle, it's been very interesting to see them rebound back up the table when most of us tipped doom and gloom for them. So it's great that the I guess we're able to talk about different clubs up at the sharp end of the table. So that's definitely been a positive development this far into the season. And well, I'll throw Daniel's last question back at you, and I probably should have asked you this while we were wrapping up the Vissel Niigata game. But what are Kobe currently doing right, which they didn't do last season? I mean, is this a podcast in and of itself? It just seems like they underperformed for so much of last season, whereas this year the manager, Mr. Yoshida, just appears to be getting as much as he should out of the sum of his parts, whereas last year it was obviously an annus horribilis from the start.
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer fully, because there are still things that I'm scratching my head at, like, why has Daiki Maekawa suddenly become a dependable goalkeeper when he hadn't been for many years? Why has Yuki Honda been a really good signing when he couldn't get into the Kyoto side last year? Likewise, when did Yamakawa learn to play at centre-back? And there are various issues, things that I'm not really sure how to understand, but they've benefited really from just a settled team. They know exactly the way they're playing. There's no chopping or changing of formation. It's always a 4-3-3. The midfield is really settled with Saito and Yamaguchi, who I think are fantastic. That partnership has been really good. And they haven't looked to shoehorn Iniesta in yet. It might happen at some stage, but with that base of Saito and Yamaguchi, I think they have the ability to do Iniesta's running. So I don't think, if they do bring Iniesta in, I don't think that completely tears apart the system at all. I think it is a potential there. I think Osako he's been fit. He's looked really good. Muto's also been fit. Good in parts, not shooting necessarily, but I think the combination has looked really good. And Yuruki's improved as well in the last couple of games. So, yeah, settled team. Everyone knows what their job is. I think they're really relying on that. And, yeah, to me, I've got to give a lot of credit to those defenders, because Yamakawa, Hatsue, Honda, and Maekawa, I'll add in there, they don't scream title-winning defence to me, but they have all performed above and beyond their usual abilities and have been fantastic. And to see, like, Kikuchi's been out pretty much all season, Tula has been out, Ino's been out, so we've dealt with that, I think, is, yeah, really good. But it just seems like they've gone more back to basics with their defence. It's not... they're not trying necessarily to play out really intricately. They're a bit more, if we have to get rid of it, we'll get rid of it. And I think that's really benefited them. But that midfield, Saito, what a signing that he is. He's been on loan. Why Gamba didn't try and get him again, I don't know. Why Shonan are just still loaning him out again, I don't know. But it's worked out really well for Kobe.
Yeah, I guess he just doesn't fancy the Lemon Gas Stadium at all, Saito. But, yeah, he would it looks like he'd fit in anywhere. But, yeah, he's been terrific for them. And, one of the key components of their midfield so far this season. And, yeah, your point on Muto and Osako is a good one, because they were out, obviously, for so much of last year. But, yeah, to have them fit and firing from the start of the season has been definitely a plus, even though, as you say, yeah, Muto's yet to find his shooting boots. But, a really interesting trio of questions there, Daniel. So thank you ever so much for those. And we'll leave the teams knotted together in third then. And we're probably leaving the best till last, are we, Sam, as we move on to the final game of the match day to review. Sadezo Osaka 2, Sapporo 3. You knew that Sapporo were not going to let you down for a second straight week, Sam. It was a terrific performance away at Sadezo. Again, another team struggling in the early going when many tipped them to finish higher up the table. They're just a position above Frontale on goal difference, the same number of points after seven games. They've found life difficult so far this year. But for Sapporo, this was a terrific performance, as they were basically they took the lead on three occasions, and whenever Sadezo equalised, they were able to hit back almost immediately. Takaro Kaneko, one of the heroes of my fantasy team this week, gave Sapporo a sixth-minute lead. And after Leo Ciara equalized from the penalty spot 8 minutes later, Kaneko got Sapporo back in front. Yeah, within the next minute, his cross in from the left, in from the right, evaded Kim Gun-hee and went straight in. The J-League initially gave the goal to Kim. I guess they figured he must have gotten a touch on it as it sailed into the net. But, yes, that was later corrected to Kaneko's goal, much to my joy. Ciara got his second of the game with a tremendous leaping header from 6 yards just past the hour. But, again, Sapporo had a response. And 3 minutes after that, they went ahead for the third time when Shunta Tanaka was thinking how I should describe this, Sam. It was a near post header slash shoulder slash back from Akito Fukamori's corner. I don't know exactly which part of his body it hit, but it went in. And yes, that was three more points for Sapporo to take them into the top half of the table after match day 7.
Yeah, they all count. Who cares what it came off in the end? Tanaka surely doesn't. And this was a great response from Sapporo, considering the woeful nature of the goals they were conceding last week. Yes, they still conceded two here, and I don't think they're ever going to be able to rely on themselves defensively. But going forward, they were really good. And yeah, the responses to being equalised against them were terrific. Kaneko, this was maybe last season, I don't think he was quite as good as he had been the previous year. But yeah, he seems to have stepped up a little bit this year. And I thought he was magnificent in this game, involved in pretty much everything that Sapporo did. And as well as the goals that they scored, they had the better chances as well. And they had a goal ruled out for offside, a very tight offside against Asano. They had other good chances where Kim made reasonable saves. So yeah, it was a really positive display from Sapporo. Not so from Cerezo, although they took their goals. Ciara's movement to get the penalty was very good, and yeah, dispatched that. And his header was very good as well. But considering they just beat an F Marinos, and thought, okay, maybe that's the start of their season, really getting up and running, I thought they were torn apart quite easily defensively, which isn't usually what you'd think of with Jonic there, and Toriumi's fairly decent, Matsuda's always good. So you would expect a bit better from them defensively, but I thought Sapporo just overwhelmed them, and really deserved the victory. I thought 3-2 was even a little bit harsh on Sapporo given the way they played.
Yeah, terrific stuff. So they're very Jekyll and Hyde, aren't they, Sapporo? But that's what we love about them. And on Sunday, I can't remember which is the good one. So yeah, the good one turned up, and they put in an excellent performance and deserved the 3 points. All right then, so that's all nine games from J1 Match Day 7 rounded up. So we'll look ahead ever so briefly to Match Day 8 then, with all games on Saturday. There's a couple I could pick out, but it's rude of me to step on your toes there, Sam. In Match Day 8, what is Sam's pick of Saturday?
Sam's pick of Saturday.
Oh, it's a tough one, and I think a personal vendetta is going to come in, because I'm going to go with Kashima versus Kobe, which should surely be the end of Daikiwa Masa's run at Kashima. I think this is a massive game for them, because they've not turned up all season. They need a response from their result against Kashima, and if he can't find one here, it's going to be a tough game against the league leaders, obviously. But Kashima need to show that they are a big football club. They need to show that they've got the players that should be fighting at the top end of the table. And what better test than Kobe coming to town? I think it should be a really interesting game. It's got the response from Kashima is just, it really interests me. Is he going to change the way they play up? Is he going to look to be more positive, play a bit more football? Because if he's not, Kobe are going to just run through them. So yeah, that's my really intriguing game, and I kind of want an away victory, and I don't usually back Kobe as a neutral.
Yeah, interesting stuff. There's a couple of derbies on the slate. So, I think for me, the pick of Saturday is probably the Kanagawa derby, with the Shonan hosting Yokohama F Marinos. Shonan have been very entertaining at times this season and have notched up a couple of big scores. Obviously, I'm not expecting them to do that to the reigning champions at the Lemon Gas Stadium, but I'm sure they will provide an interesting test for Kevin Muscat's team. And as Shaunan look to maybe hook on to the coattails of the current top six, they won't want to get cut adrift of them. And what better way to announce themselves as a real player in J1 this year than by taking down the champions. So we'll see how they get on. There's also a Kansai derby on the slate with the Kyoto hosting Gumba, who have obviously just won for the first time and will look to build on that. Urawa Sapporo should be entertaining. I think I'll give Niigata the week off, even though they host a third place Fukuoka. I've been mentioning Albert X's games quite a lot recently, so we'll see how that one goes. And is it panic stations at Todoroki when Kawasaki host Nagoya? We'll wait and see if there's a response from the Todoroki powerhouse, if they can breach the usually watertight Nagoya defense. They have certainly done a number on Nagoya a couple of times at Todoroki in recent years, so we'll see if history repeats there. But there we go, Sam. Another bumper episode, obviously, with Dan giving us so much in part one. We're happy for it to run as long as it does. And with the questions as well coming in from Brett, Jonathan and Daniel, they've added so much to the episode. So it's been terrific. Let's hope to match it all when we review match day 8 next week.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like that you've hedged your bets after a 0-0 pick last week to go with about five different games just in case one of them. I spotted that. But yeah, great episode. Well, I thought it was a good episode listening to Dan. I thought thanks again for answering all those questions. Thanks to Daniel and Brett for their questions as well. So yeah, great to have those come in. Yeah, if you ever have questions you want to send into the podcast, just fire them away and I'll get Ben to sort them out and send them across to me. But looking forward to another really interesting weekend of J League action. Oh, it's just the Saturday, isn't it, for J1, all between, I don't know what time it is, 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. my time, so whatever that's is for you. So that's perfect for me at least.
Yeah, 2 p.m. The first games get going, and then there's three at 4 p.m. So a nice tight window for you there, Sam. And for the record, the Kanagawa Derby is my pick of Saturday. Just thought I'd throw in a little extra flavour for the listeners to whet their appetite for the match day to come. All right then, so that's it for this week's episode of the J Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Dan Orlowitz for his time in part one. We'd like to once again thank Daniel, Jonathan and Brett for their questions, and Sam for his questions as well that we mixed up and threw at Dan in part one as well. We'd like to thank all of our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/jtalkpod. And listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up J1 match day 8. Speak to you then. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.